Welcome to Be Nice or Leave. I'm your host, Polly Hammond. In a world where businesses are facing new challenges and heightened competition, empathy is becoming an increasingly important tool to better understand your customers, improve communication, and ultimately lead to increased profits. Through interviews with business leaders and experts, this series explores the ways in which empathy can help organizations overcome these challenges, to be better and to do better. Most importantly, we'll hear from the people who have made it happen and can see the positive impact it has had on their organization. So whether you're a business leader, an entrepreneur, or simply someone interested in the intersection of empathy and business, Be Nice or Leave is the podcast for you. I'm delighted to be joined today by my friend Rowena Kerr-Lewis, the CEO and co-founder of Denomination, a globally acclaimed design agency that specializes in the drinks industry and has long been setting the standard for sustainable design. Ro and I have shared the stage before, and I can tell you firsthand that her expertise in branding and design is unparalleled and makes for a very insightful conversation. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Fantastic.
Ro, so glad to have you here. It's only taken us, I think, a year to actually make this podcast happen. So high five. It's nice to see your lovely face and to have you join us.
Polly, so great to talk. Loved when we actually connected at the last conference. I think it was in Bendigo in Australia. So, yeah, and here we are back in the Northern Hemisphere. So,
and it was your birthday and you got out just in time because I did a press junket for a week after that. And we were literally like just in front of the floods the entire way on that. So you were quite lucky.
Yeah, I was very lucky and I managed to get home and have a family dinner. So I earned brownie points there. So it's all good.
100%. So of course, this podcast is not so much about wine. This series is not so much about wine, although you are an expert in drinks and wine branding and packaging design. I am the first person to admit that I'm a total fangirl of your work. I told you when we met that when I was growing up, all I wanted to be was a graphic designer. And my family was like, no, you won't make any money and you'll sleep on people's couches. And that's not a degree that you can get.
And there I noticed truth in that, Polly.
Oh, shush. No. Well, I mean, so Denomination, are you going on 30 years now?
We are 21 years this year. So, yeah, it seems like a really long, but super fun journey, from starting with like two of us with, babes in arms, literally babies. I think my eldest was 4 months old when we started the business to where we are now, which has been a very exciting journey, actually, when you look back on it. And 20 years is a nice point in time to go, wow, this is pretty cool what we've been able to do in a couple of decades.
It's so funny because we started our first business when I was 3 months pregnant with our eldest child. And I've looked back on it and I'm like, there was nothing like the desperation of knowing that you had a mouth to feed that made us work. And it just completely changed I had a good work ethic before, but I mean, like, I was driven to make those businesses a success. All right. Well, one of the things that I noticed, because I have my little fangirl thing, is that when we were in Oz, you were answering questions about design and you could have stayed at that podium for another hour, 90 minutes easily. And people wanted to ask you questions because design is interesting. It's beautiful. We interact with it in everything that we do. Everybody has an opinion on design. Mm-hmm. I have always felt like that design is the ultimate tangible representation of empathy, right? To have good design, you have to have done your research, your understanding, your soft, approach, as well as have all of the numbers on it. Can you start by talking to us about your approach to designing specifically with the customer in mind?
Yeah, you're probably the first person outside of design who's talked in that in that way, because and I think you've pinpointed why some designs are really successful and others aren't. And one of the things that we talk about internally is having empathy with the end consumer. And if you have that end consumer in mind, if you can put yourself in their shoes, then you will come up with a design for a brand that truly meets their needs, whether they be physical needs or emotional needs. But you're actually really delving in deep to make sure that there is that connection between your brand, and that comes through from the design, and the consumer. And I would say that that is why a lot of our designs are really successful in market, and commercially successful is something that we obviously aim to do every time. But they are commercially successful because they hit this button. They either hit this button because it's a practical solution to what they're looking for, or it fulfills an emotional need. And I think you really need empathy in order to get to that outcome. So when we're doing internal reviews, one of the phrases that I'm sure our designers get really sick of is, put yourself in the consumer's shoes. Can you read the typography? What do you feel when you see that label? And so, you know, making sure that our designers are thinking consumer first at every point, I think makes the difference between a pretty label and a brand that is going to stand the test of time.
So what kind of inputs does that require? Is that you going out to clients and saying, I want your market data? Is it surveys and forms? Is it hunches? You know, I mean, your team has done this for a long time. You have a lot of internal knowledge. How do you actually frame that persona or that understanding of what's going to resonate with the audience?
Well, I think there's two parts of it. There is the theoretical data-driven side, which is really important. So we use many different sources, but one of the main ones we rely on is Wine Intelligence, that create a series of consumer portraits that paint a beautiful picture of who that target audience is. And it's really interesting with their particular models. You can really look at them and go, oh, I know someone who is like that. I know my uncle fits into that and my neighbor fits into that. So those are, and they're all based on both qual and quant data in order to come up with those profiles. We also do a lot of just desktop research of different reports from Nielsen and the like, that really kind of builds up our knowledge of how consumers behave. The more kind of emotional way is being a really good listener and an observer. And so, you know, when I am out with people, and it's not necessarily in a social environment, it's at my hairdresser's, it's at the corner store, it's, you know, in a liquor shop, it's wherever I am. I talk about drinks because that's my livelihood, but also my passion. And I ask lots of questions, and I want to know why people buy things and why they don't buy things, why they appeal, where do they use it, what's the occasion, paint me a picture. And the same thing is the sort of observation when we're out, you can kind of see how people are interacting with brands and make assumptions as to why they're doing it. So you're looking at it both by those two levels. And I think being an acute listener and observer is as important as understanding the data as well.
Look, I hear on that. I think that, you know, when I look at creativity and when we look about what forms amazing creatives, it's that you're a curious minded person, you know, whether it's history, research, maps, future, space. I mean, there's just like, there's so much going on around us all the time that we can tap into, and then being able to synthesize that, right? To say, oh, well, how does the discussion around what we're calling, like, I'm on a space cake right now, so I'm talking about space. How does the discussion around the language you're using to describe the Webb telescope, which has been quite controversial, what does that actually tell us about the changing nature of consumers and language and equality? I notice that on the marketing side of things, I often say that we are the customer in the room. We're the customer advocate in the room. And sometimes those are hard conversations where we're having to sit there with a client and say, I understand that XYZ is important to you, but this is what we know from the consumer. Do you feel like that in a design sense that you and your denomination team have to sit in rooms with stakeholders and help them understand what matters to their audience?
Oh, very much. And I think when you're dealing with professional marketers, less so, because that's part of their education and their skill set. Not all the time, but mostly. It's when you sometimes deal with, I find particularly when there is an emotional relationship between the winemaker or the wine owner and the designers, that sometimes it's really tough for them to divorce their own personal likes and dislikes from that of their consumers. So if they are actually building a brand that is going to appeal to them, to consumers like them, then that's an easy conversation to have. But if they are building a brand that is nothing to do with them, they need to trust the experts that do have that knowledge and do have that expertise. So we have certain processes in place to enable that to happen. So, you know, when we have a discussion with a client, there is some gentle guiding that we provide. Gentle being the operative word, we're not the sort of agency is like, you will do as we say. You know, it is a conversation and a collaboration. But we gently guide them to open their minds to understanding the consumers. And we build a reverse brief that details exactly what we're going to do and educate the client in when they're assessing designs to assess them objectively against the criteria that we've all agreed to. And I think when you do that process, and it sounds kind of, you know, a little formulaic, but it's a really helpful guide to get the clients to think consumer first and objectively about design, rather than color the conversation and the assessment of design with their own subjectivity.
Right. I find myself repeatedly, and maybe more on internal conversations than external conversations, saying form follows function, you know, like the design serves a purpose. It's not just meant to be pretty pictures or, God forbid, clip art. But with that in mind, I mean, it evolves. There are certainly trend setters. I can't think, you know, when we go through customer qualitative research, one of the ones that always comes up is Apple. I mean, Apple has completely dominated the way that people engage with design and understand design. Culture's changed, especially over the last 3 years. Knowledge, access, technology has changed. What challenges are you or your clients facing as you try to stay true to brand, heritage, design, but also evolve through how people are changing, channels are changing, and technology is changing?
Yeah, I think it is an interesting and challenging one. You know, we've worked on Penfolds for 20 years. In fact, I've worked on it for longer than that, but it's just showing my age. And that is a heritage brand, but a brand very much with a foot in the present and another foot moving into the future. You know, I think they've done it incredibly well of being able to hold on to their heritage but remain relevant for consumers today and in the future. It is a balance, and I think one of the things you need to be always conscious of when you've got a heritage brand is, again, putting yourself in the shoes of consumers. You know, does this feel old-fashioned and not relevant to my life? Or can I see that by buying that brand, I'm buying someone's expertise over 200 years, but they're with me, they suit my lifestyle, my culture, my sense of who I am. So when you're designing with a heritage brand, you're kind of having to juggle the tension between those two things. And I think when you do it successfully, you're able to make sure that these heritage brands don't feel fuddy-duddy. They don't feel like what my grandmother drank. They feel like I am buying into this incredible heritage, but all equally so, it feels right for me today.
And what about this ongoing rhetoric of the new consumer? They're younger, they're hipper, they don't want as much booze, they're drinking differently, all of that. And we see brands who are reactively wanting to jump into that space. Do you go with the flow on that? Or do you have to, as like brand guardian, stop and say, whoa, hold on. We're going to, you know, this is going to degrade a brand. This is going to require education and messaging. How do you control that leaping before looking tendency?
Through a lot of discussion and debate and pushback, to be honest. I think it's everyone is after Gen Z and millennials in almost every brief. And I think what some of the brands are missing is the fact that there are other audiences in the world that are not Gen Z and millennials, and I happen to belong to one of the other generations. And that those consumers are also high purchasers of wine. They also kind of forget that this is an ongoing thing. So once millennials will start, and they're in their 40s now, they're starting to get older. And as they get older, their tastes change. So it's not just like a static thing. It's constantly moving and changing. And so, you know, as one generation moves on, another generation comes. And I think you need to be able to understand what are those triggers for those different generations as they sort of move through their lives and how that influences their decision-making process. When we've got new brands or brands that we want to really reposition for a Gen Z audience, then that is something that has certain, there are certain triggers that we need to be able to enact with our brands, because that generation, particularly Gen Z, I'd say more than millennials, has particular characteristics that are non-negotiable. So say sustainability, you know, if you look at the majority of Gen Z, they are incredibly articulate. They understand how to find information on the internet fast. They demand that the brands that they buy do good, and they want proof of that. And so that is a different sort of mentality to say Gen Y or X or boomers. And so when you're designing for that generation, you have to be able to make sure that you're communicating exactly what that brand is and working with the marketers and the winemaker, everyone else behind, to make sure that there is truth and credibility behind the claims that you are making on that label, either semiotic claims or in language, because it's really easy to be caught out by that generation because they're so digital savvy that they just will, and your brand can be wrecked in a nanosecond if you're not truthful and authentic to what you're saying you are.
In other words, no room for bullshit. There's no room for bullshit anywhere. So I'm glad that you mentioned Penfolds, which introduces another question. How do you manage globality? How do you deal with international perspectives when you are literally working cross borders for brands? You know, what are some of the challenges with getting to the heart of, in some cases, vastly different consumer profiles for the same product simply because we've crossed into another country or another region?
I think you can do it in a few ways. I think if the brand story is universal enough in its appeal, it will appeal to consumers all around the world, no matter who they are. You can also do things like change some of the packaging to appeal to a certain culture. So, for example, the Penfolds, the gifting designs that we do for the China market are very different to what we do for the UK market. They just have a different feel, they have different messaging, and they still feel very Penfolds, but they appeal to the cultural nuances of that particular audience in China versus someone who lives in the UK or, say, Australia.
Sure. Do you ever get it wrong?
Yes, we do. I mean, that's the thing. Nothing is, I guess we have a very entrepreneurial attitude, and that is that, you know, people will get it wrong, just fail fast. So, but I would say that it's not, we don't get it wrong a lot.
But you get it wrong less often than other people get it wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is why you hire professionals, right there, and not your nephew. We have this joke in digital. I'm like, every winery, and God, this is why this is not a wine podcast officially. Like, the number of times that we meet a winery and their websites were built by their nephew, and we're just like, okay, we love you, and we're so glad that it's gotten you to this point, but now let's actually put some thought into it. So you get things wrong less often than people's nephews.
Yeah.
So like in the context of tech and digital advancement, and of course, I think it's not even just that the tech has changed, but our adoption of it has changed. You know, QR codes being the biggest example of something that changed unexpectedly in the past 3 years. How has technology changed the demands, both from your clients, but also the demands of the consumer that you're factoring into new work?
I don't actually think about it as demands. I always think about it as opportunities. I think that the technology advancements that we're seeing at the moment are just so exciting, and I think that they are going to provide our consumers and brands with just more opportunities to engage at a deeper level. So, you know, QR codes are fascinating because apart from Asia, who have used them beautifully for years, you know, just doing their supermarket shopping while they're on the metro, no one else has really used them until, of course, the pandemic. And, you know, we've just done a design called Crate, which is a sustainable design. It's a labelless bottle, and everything is actually up on the capsule, the brand, the mandatories, the barcode, but also a QR code. So that QR code is actually taking the place of a label, but it's taking the place of a label, and it's taking you to a digital world of that brand as soon as you scan it. Because there's no label, I think, and it's very new on the market, so I'll need to have this.
It was proof. Actually my next question for you was about the Crate bottles. So yeah, go for it. Tell us all about the Crate bottles and the research and the design and the decision-making, because I love this so much.
Okay, so let me put that technology on pause because I'll come back to it. So Crate is going to be a really controversial design. I was just looking at a LinkedIn post today, and they were like, of someone else who'd written about it, and there were already 37 comments, and he'd posted it yesterday. So Crate was, our client wanted to create a brand of which all of the money that he could went into the quality of the wine and not the packaging. So sustainability is really key to this particular client with everything that we do. And so it had to be a really sustainable brand with fantastic quality wine inside, but literally he did not want to spend money on the packaging. So those two things just came together for us to create a brand that was all about the wine and get rid of any superfluous packaging that we could. So the bottle is clean. It uses, the bottle itself uses a transition glass, which is when a bottle manufacturer changes their glass tanks from one color to another, say Arctic blue to French green, there is a sort of 2-day lapse where they're running out of that glass and they have to keep on pumping out bottles till they get the color perfect for the next glass. So these glass colors are odd colored because they're sort of a mixture of two colors in various hues.
Was that an Eschdahl bottle?
No, it's actually from, it is from OI. Aurora in Australia. But all bottle manufacturers have this. So normally what they do with what we call transition glass is they crush it and use it as what we call industrial recycling, and it goes back into the chain. But the problem is you've used a whole lot of energy in order to make that glass, right? And then using energy to crush it and then to reuse it. So what we're trying to do with that transition glass is to make the most of the energy that's already been used to produce it. So first of all, that's our transition glass. It's in the lightest weight mold possible. So it's, I think, about 330 grams as opposed to sort of 510, 550 of a normal bottle. So we do that. Then we say, well, we have to have a capsule. We have to actually, you know, close the bottle. So the capsule is a non-negotiable. So can we do a brand that has no label whatsoever and put all of that information on a tiny piece of material that actually has the brand name, the varietal, the vintage, the region, a little kind of bit of copy, all of the mandatories, so, you know, the outfall, standard drinks, preservatives, the barcode for scanning, and then a QR code that will then help tell the story of the wine. And that is it. So there is no label. So having no label means that there is no paper required. And paper, you know, as the world has moved to a, is moving to a plastic-free world, which it can't come soon enough, but as we are moving towards that, the pressure on paper and therefore our forests is increasing dramatically. That is leading to deforestation and a further pressure on flora and fauna. So paper is a great product, but we need to be really careful and mindful about how we use that particular resource. Now, when you label bottles, the paper comes on a PET liner, so a plastic liner. So you need the plastic in order to get the label onto the bottle. When you put the label on the bottle, it's also got glue. Now, glue is made from chemicals, and there is a toxicity, that is a result of those chemicals. So you know, there's stuff that you can then remove from the environment as well. When you print onto the label, most printers use mineral-based inks, which are not fantastic for the environment. They use varnishes, they use high-build screens, all of these things that have toxicity. So when you remove just a label, you're actually removing so much. You're removing the need for plastic, for pressure on that resource, and for all of those chemicals that you would otherwise have to use. So it seems kind of simple, but actually from a sustainability perspective, you're actually taking out an enormous amount. So now you've just left with a clean bottle, transition glass, and a capsule. The carton is made from 100% recycled paper, and it has just a very simple two-color print, minimal graphics, again, reducing our ink usage. And so this whole package is about sustainability. Now, what it is going to do, and is already doing, even though it's just been launched a week or so ago, is that it's opening up the conversation for everyone, brand owners, marketeers, designers to think, what can we do differently? How can we still continue to have a brand that connects and speaks to people and that they can know, trust, love, adore, pass on their recommendations, but also does branding differently in a world where we need to minimize our impact. So Crate is going to be a conversation starter. It's not the answer for everyone, but it certainly is already creating a huge amount of debate and amongst literally everyone in our industry, or in both industries, in design as well as the drinks industry. And I think it will help open up people's ideas and creativity as how we continue to brand our products, because brands are incredibly important for consumers and businesses, but how we do that in a way that is not the conventional way of doing it at the moment. So it's one step towards the future. It's not, as I said, it's not the full answer, but it is definitely a step towards the future.
So many questions. All right, so first question, doesn't it take someone like Denomination behind you to be able to roll out with this? Because this seems like something that could equally be done in what I'm going to describe as maybe a more amateurish way. You know, like this could, the actual decisions right behind it could be done, but it wouldn't have the gravitas of this is why and how we've done this. So I just can't see many agencies or in fact wine brands in the world getting by with this kind of decision.
It's a fair question. I think because we've been doing sustainability training as a business for over 3 years now, and that's company-wide. So we have sustainability training every 2 weeks for an hour. Our team are arguably the best versed in sustainability and packaging of any agency.
I love that you will say that. I love, and especially not to go all like feminist on it, but I also love that as a woman you will say that, because I notice that it's very difficult for the most part for women to go out and say, you know what, we are the very best person in our particular field. So yeah, high five on that one.
Thank you. Well, we do believe that, and that's not sort of false rhetoric. Like we put in the hours, and I think the results are on the table for that. I think, you know, we started this sustainability drive because we felt we had a position at the table. You know, we work for most of the big wine companies and drinks companies around the world. And at the end of the day, all of our clients are in the agricultural industry, and our agricultural industries are the ones that are most affected by climate change. And so we have a duty of care to protect their businesses and our business, because we're a supplier to their businesses, to make sure we address the fundamental issues that are facing us in climate change. And if we have a seat at the table, we can push that agenda. We can help guide, educate, and train and challenge our clients. So that is what we do, not just with this particular client, that Fourth Wave that owns Crate, but with all of our clients. Some of them are they're all on journeys at, you know, some of them are on just started the journey, and some of them are a long way down. But I would say that some, like Fourth Wave, where sustainability is at their heart, and that they absolutely question everything that we do to make sure it has a sustainable footprint, are probably, and they've got quite an entrepreneurial attitude, are probably able to do these things that we recommend and create more so than others. I just don't know of another agency that would have that level of knowledge in terms of all of the aspects of the packaging materials to be able to justify why this is a more sustainable option than others.
Right. So basically that would be a fluke as opposed to a mindful decision. Like, exactly. So it's funny that you would say that, not to really like go too far into Five Forests, but we have for many years now taken a really, a very mindful approach to digital sustainability, because it was one of those things that nobody knew about. I mean, even now, nobody knows about it. Tiny little cohort talking about what is the impact on our digital choices. Because in wine, what we saw is we saw brands, I mean, like huge, well, fabulous global brands who had this hardcore sustainability message, but were putting 15 megabyte videos up on their homepage and had no idea that, you know, there's actually an impact on energy consumption for everything that we do through these screens in front of us. And excuse me. And what we found is when people hear about it, like when I talk to journalists about it, they're like, whoa, that's really, really neat. But it's also so nascent that people are really intimidated by it. You know, like, oh, does it mean that I have to go whole hog? And if I get anything wrong, I'm going to be in trouble. And how do I message it? And is this all just full of shit? And so I like that you say, you know, there's a journey. There's a journey. And also that this is holistic, that we can't, you know, I'm not going to demonize digital, because I love it any more than you're going to demonize, you know, paper as an actual resource. But just growing more and more aware that every decision we make, from, you know, how we run our offices to how we source our products, has such a profound impact. With that in mind, you have a whole future-proof framework, right? That you employ in-house and with your clients. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So we have this future-proof model that's sort of divided. Overall, it's about helping our clients on their sustainability journey, and there are sort of different aspects to it. But simply that there is an aspect of analysis and recommendations. So, you know, really looking at every aspect of the supply chain in terms of packaging. We're not going to be looking at, you know, viticulture or anything like that, but in terms of packaging, understanding exactly what our clients are doing and where they can improve in terms of their sustainability footprint. The second part is doing training, so actually working with, particularly with marketers, to get them to be mindful about those decisions. So exactly what you're saying about digital sustainability, it's as soon as you tell someone that actually blockchain technology is really energy intensive, then it changes the conversation, because they, unless they know, they're just operating in blindfold ignorance. So part of that training is to really impart the knowledge that we've given them into sort of bite-sized chunks that they can then take away and have an impact on the way that they do business. And then workshops is another one. You know, once we've done training and certainly once we've done that sort of immersion, okay, well, how are we going to use this information to make our products better? You know, what else can we do? And actually facilitating those workshops with the clients. And the aim is to make our clients activists within environmental sustainability. I mean, I keep on talking about sustainability, but what I'm talking about here is planet sustainability. Right, there's a whole nother thing about people that we can
finance,
talk about.
Finance, governance, yeah.
But how, you know, once they're mindful and they've you know, it only takes a session from us and they become really committed and you know, intent on doing good. And if we can create that amongst not just our clients, but amongst our community, our global community of drinks experts, then we will start slowly to see a difference.
I have a lot of feedback from people that the conversation around sustainability, and just like right now, we had to jump in and say, we're talking about environmental sustainability, that the different certifications and the different messaging and all of your options and bad report, or not bad reporting, but reporting about bad things, right? And fear of screwing up, that it has really created this opaque space that brands don't feel 100% confident. And actually, it's really funny. You know what it is? It's brands who know that there's a lot to be done don't feel really confident talking about it because they realize there's so much more we could be doing. Whereas brands who are like, you know, performative greenwashers, they're like, yeah, we're going to splash it out everywhere. Do you see sustainable messaging as like, is it evolving? Is there a way that we can learn to communicate with more precision, that we can cover our asses when things change? So just like there was the Vera reporting about in The Guardian about what was going on with tree planting. And I know that we've had emails because we participate in some reforestation projects. Like, how do we actually talk so that it gives us space to grow and evolve and screw up sometimes and safely become more sustainable?
I think it's just about being truthful and also factual. So I think the greenwashing legislation that's coming in the EU is a really good start, and that will hopefully stop people from making these wild claims that are really unsubstantiated. I think if you look at that crate example, we haven't said we are a sustainable wine brand, or, you know, we are planet friendly or anything like that. What we said is something, I can't remember the tagline, that's terrible. It was something like great wine, minimal packaging, no paper, no film, no inks, or no just be 100% really
factual.
Clear.
This is what we've done.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can do that in a number of ways. If it's just as so, and consumers, especially those younger consumers, are after the facts. So if you say, you know, you have a statement on your website that says, you know, this is a digitally sustainable website where we are using minimal technology, minimal energy to it's just being truthful, just being honest. They're not expecting, consumers are not expecting perfection, but they are expecting action, and as much action as you can take. And so that's what I keep on saying to the clients. Don't wait until you've got everything perfect. Just start with one thing, then get that one thing and then move on to another. So just keep going little by little, but please start. Because if you keep waiting for it all to be perfect, you are going to A, miss the boat, and B, it's going to be so expensive to then get to the point that you need to get to. So just start now.
We say the exact same thing. We're like, it's okay, just start somewhere. And we do all that. And it helps build buy-in, and people can see that you're growing and you're just like us. I mean, you know, on the marketing side of it, you use slightly different language to promote it, but totally the same thing. So one last thing that I want to talk about that I'm just super curious if you're seeing. Everybody knows LVMH numbers, wealth is skyrocketing, luxury is going whole hog. We have actually seen a lot of brands in wine, but across categories, working to reposition themselves in luxury. And I get asked a lot, well, what are the markers of luxury? And I am finding, and maybe it's that I'm jaded, I'm not certain. I'm finding that there are these ideas around what luxury is that maybe are not in line with what consumers think luxury should be. Are you able to talk a little bit about what you're seeing transition in luxury packaging and luxury design?
Yeah, there are two versions of luxury. There is this sort of old and new. So the old is the display of wealth, sort of ostentatious display of brand, and the sort of all bells and whistles on a very sort of
maximalist
perspective.
Gold, yeah, everything,
maximalist, exactly.
Bird cages Chandeliers, around your bottles.
Gold,
and
you
shit.
Got it.
Yeah.
There is the new luxury consumer that has the same characteristics, similar characteristics, kind of wherever you go in the world. And that new luxury is more about subtlety, detail, experience than old luxury. So if you look at something that's completely out of category, like the travel industry, luxury used to be about, you know, super big, high-end cruises or fabulous places in Monte Carlo and, you know, that kind of like overt kind of stuff. Now, that new luxury, super expensive travel experience is taking private tours to isolated places in the world that are unattainable from normal people like me.
Most of us, right?
Most of us. But, you know, actually taking them to these incredible parts of nature pushing their own sort of boundaries and perceptions, and that is what new luxury is all about. So when you then apply that thinking back to your brands, think about experience, whether it's opening the bottle, whether it's a signature serve, whether it's how it's packaged, whether it's all of the other things that actually surround that brand, is really important to that new luxury. How do you do new luxury in a sustainable way? You know, I think Ruinart did it so beautifully with their second skin. You know, it then makes everyone else look just so tizzy and over the top when you've got this beautiful second skin pulp paper around the bottle that reminds you of the caves of Ruinart. Like it's got this lovely storytelling, and it just feels just so beautiful and innovative and different and disruptive in a market. And that's what I mean about new luxury. So it's not lots of gold foil and drawers and stuff. It's actually just being really pared back and considered and layered with what you do.
Awesome. I love that answer. All right, Ro, I'm so grateful for your time. I know you've shoehorned this in, and I have dozens more questions that I can ask you about all of this. So maybe 6 months down the line, we need to do like the part two on it. But thank you. It's been fabulous.
Oh, Polly, I would love to do that again. And so great to see you. Cheers, Polly.
And that's a wrap. A huge thanks to my wonderful guest, Rowena Kerr-Lewis, for joining me today. And thank you, my amazing listeners, for hanging out with us. We couldn't do this without you. If you're interested in learning more about how empathy can transform your business for good, make sure to hit that subscribe button. And if you have any questions or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me online at fiveforest.com or on social media at fiveforest. I'll add the links to the description. See you next time.